Women-made media is so important, and why we all need to tune in to Feminist Magazine on KPFK.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse coalition of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
In today's digital world, search engines are often seen as neutral tools that simply help us find information. But what if the results we get from these platforms aren't as unbiased as we think? What if they're shaped by hidden forces, reinforcing harmful stereotypes and limiting access to knowledge? This is the premise of Dr. Sophia Noble's groundbreaking book, Algorithms of Oppression. In her work, Dr. Noble examines how search engines, particularly Google, perpetuates biases that disproportionately impact marginalized groups, especially Black women. Her research challenges the idea that technology is a neutral force and instead reveals how it can reproduce and amplify systems of oppression. I began my conversation with Dr. Noble by asking what inspired her to write Algorithms of Oppression and what was the catalyst for her research into search engines and their biases.
Well, you know, I, like many people, when an economic recession happens, found myself going back to grad school. And I was, experiencing firsthand the effects of the housing crisis in 2006 to 2008. And I was leaving corporate America at a time when just about everybody I knew was losing their jobs, getting laid off, really struggling. And when I went into academia at that time, around 2008, I was so surprised at how people in the university were talking about these new big tech platforms that were emerging. I mean, they weren't as big as they are now. This is like the early days of Facebook, when it was you needed a .edu email to be on the platform, for example, and YouTube had just kind of taken off and exploded, and people were imagining a future with that. And people in academia were talking about these platforms as if they were kind of like things like the new public library or the future of how we would access knowledge and information, almost like it was a public good. But I really knew from having been in corporate America that we were using search engines in particular to just like make our clients more visible. And I really understood them as advertising technologies, not as the new public library. And that dissonance between what I had experienced leaving industry and coming into academia was really that was just like the place that I wanted to investigate. And I was thinking, honestly, at first, what would it mean that these tech companies would decide, let's say, what the history of Black knowledge and experience and culture would be, right? That people would start to use a search engine to look for Black people and Black culture, Black history, Black knowledge. And it would be whatever the programmers decided it would be. And that was the thing that got me. And I started doing a number of searches on, well, I guess probably the most infamous one that I've done and written about was what happened when you did keyword searches on Black girls and Black women. And back then, you got almost exclusively pornography as the representation of Black girls and women. And that really was the catalyst where I said, I need to write in detail for the public and for my colleagues in academia about what a search engine is in terms of it being an advertising technology, but more importantly, what are the stakes of turning to these kinds of technologies as a guide for the future of our kind of information ecosystem or the future of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Backing up a bit for the listening audience, Break down what algorithms are. I think most people understand search engines at this point, but what are algorithms in regards to your research and what you discovered and how they work in particular?
I love that question because now here it is, you know, I don't know, we're many, many years, a decade and a half since I started this research. And a lot of people understand maybe colloquially the word algorithms. They know that it means, let's say, something a computer is doing or something software is doing to affect the kinds of experience we have online. And really, in the most technical sense, an algorithm is a set of instructions that we give to a computer to have it create a set of results for us. Okay. So, you know, you could think of it like a recipe. It's a set of instructions. That's ultimately what algorithms do. They're mathematical instructions, in fact. And they run every dimension of how we experience the internet or things on our smartphones or in computers on a daily basis. So there's an algorithm that is a set of instructions that's helping determine the shortest route in traffic if you're using a GPS tool or map tool, right? In the case of 2008, 9, 10, when I started this research, people really didn't understand what an algorithm was. It was very much computer science jargon. It was the kind of thing information scientists and computer scientists used to understand how programming was going to affect the development of a platform or a piece of software. And now, of course, what we really understand is that an algorithm is driving. You could almost think of it as the set of instructions that's going to over-determine how we experience the internet. And there's lots of different kinds of algorithms, from simple to complex, that we experience every time we're using computers. But we're also, even if we're not using computers, now that so many industries, schools, banks, landlords, you name it, are using software to make decisions, it means that all of us, in one way or another, are having decisions that affect our everyday lives determined by algorithms.
Now, knowing that, going back to your initial search for Black women, Black girls, the first thing that would pop up would be pornography. How particularly harmful do you think these algorithms are to certain groups or communities based on your research? And even though you did all this research for the book years ago, has there been a change in regards to the way in which algorithms play into maybe producing a certain level of harm or misinformation targeting certain communities and groups as well?
I love that question because I have to say that we know a lot about media and how it affects us and how it affects societies and communities, different age groups, different demographics. One of the things, for example, that we know about television after more than 50 years of really good research around television is that when you experience racist or sexist or discriminatory stereotypes in something like television or film, you know that it has impact on audiences. It has negative impact on the people who are the subjects, right? So if it's a racist algorithm toward African-Americans, then those stereotypes circulating in our society and people acting upon their negative beliefs about African-Americans will do things like embolden racism or discrimination in our society. At UCLA, we have our Ralph J. Bunche Center, and one of our professors, who's also happens to be our interim chancellor right now, has led the Hollywood Diversity Report for more than a decade with very rich research about what happens when people are misrepresented in Hollywood. Now, I was looking at that research and I was thinking about the internet and what's different about the internet when you experience derogatory images about yourself or other people. In this case, I was thinking about my daughter. You know, at the time that I was doing this research, she was a tween. And I was thinking, well, what happens when she is using a search engine and she's looking for things that other Black girls are interested in and she sees all this pornography? In that context, unlike a movie or a television show, what we're led to believe is that a search engine is bringing back to us the most reliable, the most credible, and the most truthful information, websites, and other kinds of resources. Now, that's a totally different context than knowing that Hollywood is making movies based on, you know, how much money they can make. Most people who use the internet and search engines think that they're looking and smarter people in Silicon Valley have developed these technologies to help them wade through millions of websites to bring back the very top 20, you know, the very best ones to that first page of search result. And that context of believing that what you find in a search engine is fair, reliable, truthful, credible, really, to me, is so important to study and understand. Because what that means is that not just my daughter, when she sees derogatory images about Black girls and women, but also her peers, her teachers, her employers, you know, anybody who also gets those kinds of results. And in fact, I have been at scholarly conferences in the early days of my research where I would say, well, look at how these algorithms are programmed so negatively toward Black women. And scholars themselves would stand up and say, well, maybe Black women just do more porn, which of course we know is just patently false. So the strong belief that what we get in search is very reliable is the reason why we have to interrogate what's happening there. And in course, we see this translated to the second part of your question in politics, when people are looking for information about political candidates or political issues, search engines are just ripe for misinformation, propaganda, disinformation to flow through those systems, because ultimately political action committees or candidates, campaigns that have the most money can really affect what we see in the first page or the first couple of pages of search results. And so these are resources that I think we've been encouraged to rely upon when we know very little, in fact, generally speaking, in the public about how they work.
I'm so happy you said that, because I mean, listening to you immediately, I was thinking misinformation, in particular, because I think most people don't really understand how this stuff is working. And the thought initially would be, this is a computer, it's smarter than me. But what people are failing to realize is that it's this computer generated information that we're pulling up is actually being programmed by human beings.
Absolutely. That's actually the most important dimension of remembering that. You know, everything we experience in the world, for the most part, I think outside of the natural environment, and even that is increasingly manipulated by human beings, you know, these are products of our imagination. And they're also limited by our imagination or lack thereof. I mean, we know that there are a lot of things that Silicon Valley companies do not test for, that they don't even think about looking at. We know that they don't hire, for the most part, underrepresented ethnic minorities. They don't hire women, generally speaking, certainly not as reflected in our population. So we have a narrow kind of mostly homogenous type of person who's working in Silicon Valley, who's just not asking the kinds of questions, certainly that I was asking in my research. And, you know, in the book Algorithms of Oppression, there are just dozens of examples of highly consequential problems that happen when you're doing all kinds of different searching. And what we know is that since that book came out in 2018, the companies work very hard to try to fix those problems. So there are a number of different kinds of damaging effects. And people have both made those damaging effects. Companies, unfortunately, have also profited quite a bit from the damage. And yet, when it's time to take responsibility or accountability for the harm that comes from those products, somehow then it seems to just be articulated as, It's just the computer code. We're not really sure what happened here.
You're listening to Dr. Noble, the author of Algorithms of Oppression. Now back to the show. Dr. Noble reminds us that while search engines provide quick answers, they also can erode our ability to engage in deep critical thinking necessary to navigate complex political landscapes. This shift in how we access and process information has profound implications for democracy, shaping how we understand power, history, and the decisions we make at the ballot box. To dive deeper, I asked Dr. Noble, were there specific patterns or findings that she found especially troubling about how political information is being filtered or shaped by these algorithms?
Well, one thing we know is that all of these technologies have really truncated our ability to do kind of that deep dive or long form reading and preparation and research. I'll tell you that I it's hard for me to find a colleague who's a professor or a teacher who doesn't comment at some point on how difficult it is to get students to read a lot of information or material. It's increasingly difficult to assign long articles and books, things that would have been like so easy 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Okay, so this kind of socialization around instant information, thin reading, nuggets, bite-sized bits of information, for sure impacts our ability as voters or people just interested in all kinds of things to really be able to go deep. It also leaves us vulnerable as we're kind of losing our ability to concentrate and focus on long form reading and deeper diving. We're also living in a time where our time and ability to access other people for discussion and conversation about issues is also declining. We know, for example, there's lower participation in organized religion. That might be a place where people would go and talk about politics or issues or things that are happening in their communities. People are increasingly isolated. The whole ecosystem of how we live now has compressed our time and concentration and ability to think deeply about the consequences of who we're voting for, what we're voting on. So I think in some ways, while we can just search for something like, okay, what is this proposition about? Or what is this candidate about? Or should I even vote or not? In some ways, we feel like we have more access than ever. We also, in other ways, have kind of lost other types of access or other types of knowledge and thinking and time. And I think those are very important things to consider. You know, we may have more information at our fingertips than we ever had before, but it is also increasingly difficult to make sense of what's fact, what's fiction, what we can count on, and how it's going to affect our lives.
In an era where misinformation spreads with a single click and voting rights remain under attack, the stakes for civic participation have never been higher. I turn to Dr. Noble for her insights on how voter suppression tactics are evolving and what it means for Black communities.
We want to remember that before the 2016 presidential election, Black people in particular, specifically, have been targeted with propaganda and disinformation to effectively discourage our political participation. We have people who are paid actors, paid influencers to discourage our participation in electoral politics, to encourage us to withhold our vote. We've also had massive, massive voter disenfranchisement, purging of millions of African Americans off the voting rolls. So that is also, you know, part of like what you and I experience in our families and in our communities, where people are like, I don't even know, this party's taking my vote for granted, and I'm going to withhold until they do right. Those are voter suppression tactics that people may not even be aware very smart people are also vulnerable to that kind of thing. So I just think, you know, we have to get more sophisticated and nuanced ourselves about what it means to take away our right to vote, even by convincing us that there's nobody good to vote for. And there also may not be somebody good to vote for.
Algorithms that lift up misinformation can fuel apathy among Black voters, using psychological and social strategies to discourage political participation. Propaganda may amplify the belief that voting doesn't lead to meaningful change in Black communities by highlighting systemic failures and unfulfilled promises. This overloading of negative messaging can also lead to serious emotional exhaustion and voter fatigue, making individuals feel overwhelmed and powerless to make a difference. But checking out of the political process is a slap in the face to those who fought hard for the right to vote.
Some of us are old enough to remember the stories of our own parents not being able to vote. Okay, so I think for people, let's say Generation X and older, maybe really understand the sacrifices that were made by the generation before us,
right,
to have the right to vote. And it's not like they had a lot of incredible choices, because after the Civil War, when Black men had the right to vote, there were more Black mayors in the United States than we've ever had in the history of this country. And you had massive Black voter participation coming kind of post-Reconstruction. And that was met in the 1920s with the, you know, basically the Reign of Terror, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, the perverse and profane lynchings that took place all over this country. And again, tactics to suppress and roll back Black people's voting participation and rights. And it was our parents who then were, and Black women who were finally given the right to vote with the passage of the 1964 Voting Rights Act. So when young people say we have a right to not participate, that's true. But when I think about how much blood has been spilled in this country over the profound impact that Black people could have when we did vote, then that's another way of thinking about just what it means to withhold a vote. It's not just symbolic, and it's not just about representation. It's that when Black people vote, we actually control the electorate in a lot of places where we live and can affect incredible change and empowerment. So that's another way to think about what it means to opt out.
Given the power of search engines and shaping public discourse, what are some solutions or interventions that could help mitigate the negative impacts of search engines on the electoral process?
Well, one thing we need are more search engines, not a handful of monopolies that really control the information landscape. And there are people who are trying to think about, you know, what are ways that you could access information that is more aligned with your values rather than more aligned with what's most profitable for the companies to show you. You know, I've always been, you know, a proponent since I started this research of more search engines that are specialized, that really help us to parse deep and difficult information, like voting information, at a local level. I remember even in this last election, sitting with my family and are trying to deeply investigate people and propositions and ballot initiatives. And it was very difficult. And I, you know, in the old days, we used to have like the progressive voter guides, and even those are hard to find and work your way through. So more education, more expertise that can be made visible by different kinds of technologies is far better than just those with the most money being able to surface. And of course, I'm an educator, I'm a professor, so I believe that there should be, you know, deep information and education that we can, no matter what your politics are.
Last question. What can individuals and communities do to push back against algorithmic oppression based on your research or working what you know to be fact at this point?
one of the most powerful inoculations, I think, for the public is for them to understand what these systems are, how they work. Of course, you know, my book is just one foray into understanding, and that book is very accessible. You know, it's not written so that you have to have a PhD to understand it, I promise. But knowledge is a very powerful inoculator. It helps you to slow down, think more critically, have conversations with people and experts that you trust, people who have knowledge. That I don't just mean credentialed experts. I mean people with lived experience, deeper knowledge than you do about something. All of those are different forms of inoculation. Not just trusting everything that you come into contact with online or even the systems that you're using. I think people can, use their voice and their power to support libraries and librarians. Quite frankly, those are great places to go to continue to build our knowledge and our own stores of wisdom. And I think we want to also do everything we can to kind of protect access to education, increase access to education. I mean, these are decisions we often make at a local and a state level. And participating everywhere we can in understanding that if we just leave our country and our culture to Silicon Valley to decide and to shape, you know, we're really going to lose a lot. We're already losing a lot of knowledge about how to do things. And we think of parochial, but I will tell you that knowing how to do things is very valuable. You know, at the end of the day, what happens when the power grid goes down? And you can't use your phone, and you can't use the internet, and you can't use a search engine. Do you know how to do things? Are you in community with others who know how to do things? All of that, to me, is part of the inoculation that we can control, at least in our own personhood. Of course, we can also, as workers on our jobs, we can organize on our jobs and respond to more encroachments of technology companies and impacting how our work is changing and the quality of our work is changing. You know, companies are shifting a lot of money and budget toward tech, and that budget is coming away from workers and workers' wages. So there's lots of places. You don't have to be a technologist to care about what's happening with this sector and how it's affecting your life. And there are many places where you can have a voice and push back and do something different.
Well, Dr. Noble, this has been a great conversation really about digital literacy. So again, thank you so much. And especially the point that you mentioned about us being in community. When we think about the next 4 years, that's going to be more important and significant than ever. You know, who do we go to? How do we access information, resources? Everything that you've said, and then considering how algorithms work and search engines and technology, I couldn't be more happy and pleased that I had this conversation with you. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you again so much.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your work. I will tell you that journalism is one of the most important resources that we have. And I'm just so grateful for you and your work.
I spoke with Dr. Sophia Noble, professor of gender studies, African-American studies, and information studies at the University of California, Los Angeles.
Attention all sexy boomer fans. Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show has a new time slot on Tuesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. We're just moving up 1 hour. Join us for free-form comedy, talk, and social issues co-hosted by Phil Proctor and Ted Bonnet, featuring special guests, Hollywood stars, and activists in fun and deep conversation. That's Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
I'm Lisa Detmer. I'm sure you have all heard of the shocking case of rape of Gisèle Pelicot in France by her now ex-husband and the dozens of men he solicited to rape her while she was drugged unconscious. This months-long mass rape and drugging trial concluded in France in December with the ex-husband Dominique Pellicot and 49 other men all found guilty of the rape or sexual assault of his former wife. Dominique Pellicot, 72, who solicited dozens of strangers to rape Giselle while she was unconscious, received the maximum sentence of 20 years for aggravated rape. 48 other men on trial were found guilty of aggravated rape, with two guilty of sexual assault, but did not receive the maximum penalties asked for. The trial, which has shocked France and has pushed the country to examine a culture struggling with pervasive misogyny and systemic sexual assault, has galvanized women to demand a change in the way it approaches gender-based violence. But there is also concern whether it can affect change, especially if there is complacency among France's political class. In comments that sparked fury, Mayor of Mazon, Louis Bonnet, recently said that the Pellicot case would have been far more serious, adding that no women were killed. Giselle Pellicot has won praise for waiving her anonymity and walking defiantly into the Avignon courtroom every day, sometimes behind the men accused of raping her. Giselle has become a symbol of female courage and resilience during the three-month trial, and crowds of supporters outside the courthouse in the southern city of Avignon cheered as she appeared after the verdicts had been read out. This trial was very difficult, she said at the end of the sentencing, adding that she did not regret her decision to let the case be heard public. She said, "I now have confidence in our ability to collectively seize the future in which women and men can live in harmony with respect and mutual understanding. I thank you." Dominique Pellicot denied misleading the men whom he had met online, saying they knew exactly what they were doing. Quote, he says, "I am a rapist like the others in this room." Giselle had demanded that horrifying videos of the serial abuse, which were recorded by her then-husband, should be seen in court, saying she hoped this would help other women speak up, and it looks like it has. The trial has triggered protest rallies around France in support of Giselle and spurred soul-searching, including a debate on whether to update France's rape law, which at present makes no mention that sex should involve consent. She says she hopes the enormous interest in her case will help other women who have suffered sexual abuse, and brushes off praise for her own bravery in letting the world see her pain. "It's not courage, it's determination to change things," she told the court in October. "This is not just my battle, but that of all rape victims." And recently, the founder of the website used by Dominique Pellicot to invite dozens of men to rape his wife after he drugged her was indicted on Thursday in France on myriad charges, including some related to that case. The Paris prosecutor said in a statement that the website was implicated in more than 23,000 cases in France alone from 21 to 24, involving 480 alleged victims. The cases include allegations of sexual abuse of children, pimping, prostitution, rape, drug trafficking, scams, and homicides, according to the police. During the trial, Mr. Pellicot said that he had met all the men in a private chat room on the website called Without Her Knowledge. French nonprofit organizations fighting against child abuse, homophobia, and illegal online content have been raising alarms about the site for years. A petition calling for it to be shut down was signed by more than 20,000 people. So today we talked about the Giselle Pellicot case and rape culture in France generally, and how the Giselle Pellicot case has ignited and united feminists across Europe and even across the globe to stand up publicly to support Giselle and to speak out about this ubiquitous war on women and rape culture that is accepted and normalized around the world. We talked to Blandine de Rallonger from Les Hommes d'Avignon, the French feminist group that supported Giselle at the trial.
My name is Blandine de Verlange. I live in Avignon in France, and I am a French activist, feminist. I was very active during the last month about the Pellicot trial. I am the founder of Les Amazones d'Avignon. It's a group of women, feminist activist women, who make actions in the streets, usually during the night, because it's not completely legal. We make collage, sometimes demonstrations about male violence.
And this is where the town where the court case was in, and you went to the criminal court case, the rape case of Gisèle Pelicot. How did
exactly?
Yes. What was it like to be in court watching this?
We have heard about the trial would take place in 2020, 2021. We heard that there had been a man who had organized rapes of his wife, many rapes, and with using drugs to make her sleep. And when we understood what had really taken place, it was really awful. You know, we understood how many men, how many rapes had taken place, and it meant for us that we were surrounded by rapists, in fact, concretely, as women. And as feminists, we decided to follow carefully what would take place and to be present here for the victim, Gisèle Pelicot, and for all the women, because as feminists, we are here for all the women. And we wanted to be present, to be here, to see, to watch the trial, to hear what they had to say, the victim and the rapist. And we wanted to learn what has had to be learned about it, about rape culture. So we went with my group. We are maybe three dozens of women. We organized to be present at the trial every day, in the court every day. So we managed to take some time, and we were every day, every half day, about two to four women here in the court, and we attended the trial every day. Not all the women every day, of course. I am working, I'm a teacher. I couldn't be there every day, but we managed to be there every day and we told each other what had happened the morning and the afternoon and so on every day. So we could develop a knowledge, profound knowledge of the case, and we could organize action to support Gisèle.
And what do you think the effect of Les Amazons d'Avignon and other women who responded to this case has been?
I think there are several consequences. The first is that we wanted to be here to support Gisèle. We wanted her to know that we were here as women and as feminists. We were really, really angry about what happened. And we wanted to give her some strength to be able to go every day to these horrific moments. And in fact, I think it really helped her. She told me it helped her. And her lawyers told me too. At the beginning, we have known that they believed that she could be able to go about 2 weeks to the trial before being overwhelmed by everything. But in fact, we did many actions. We made collage. And I began to applaud her every day. It was me in the court, inside the court, when she came every morning and when she left every evening. We began to applaud her. All the women present here, I saw her being so relieved when she saw us. Because you have to know, you have to understand that she was in the court with her 51 rapists and 40 lawyers, and she was alone with her children sometimes, not all the times, and two lawyers and one psychologist. So you can understand how it was not balanced for her. And the room was full of these rapists. So we were in another place with the video to watch what happened, but we were not with her. So we managed to be here when she came in and came out and went out to applaud her, so that she knew that we were here, even if she didn't see us. She knew we were here, and she looked in the public to see if we were here. And I think it really supported her. And during the trial, every week, we made collages in the streets, sentences about Giselle, about her strength, about what we heard in the court. And we managed to put the sentences on the way she came every morning. You know, she was walking in the streets and she had in front of what we made during the night. And I know that she could read that and that maybe, I'm sure she it helped her a lot. You know, I have taken picture of her in front of my college. And she told me how it was, how precious it was for her to know that she was not alone.
Plus, it wasn't just her, it was her daughter and her sons who were affected too.
Yes, she's the principal, the main victim. But her daughter, Caroline, we don't know exactly what happened to her because there are no evidences. Pedico took pictures and videos of every rape he made with other men. But for Caroline, his daughter, they found some pictures. She was obviously drugged. She was sleeping and she was naked with underwear, sexy underwear. She didn't know what it was not hers and it was not in her bed. So they found these pictures, but no evidence that she had been raped. And she has no memory, of course. So For Caroline, it's really, really hard because she's probably a victim of incest from her father. But it has not been proven, and Pellico didn't recognize that. So it's a huge violence for her. So she's the second victim. There are other victims, other women of this, of the rapists, because, you know, Pellico had apprentices. So at least two, three, or probably more men who first came in his home, and then they do exactly the same with their wives. One was Jean-Pierre Maréchal, and another one, well, so I don't have to give the names, but so they have been convicted, and it's not a very huge sentence. So they just go to jail 15 years.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA Radio, and I'm Lisa Detmer, and I am your host today. We are talking to French feminist Blandine Deverlongs about the Giselle Pellico case. Let's get back to that interview now.
I read in the Time magazine that the French feminist Hélène Duvec has said that in France, there's even greater resistance than in the Anglo-Saxon world to condemning rape by celebrities in particular. But it does seem that France has, just from being over here, has claimed that they don't have the Victorian values of the U.S. and that they're more sexually liberated. And I'm wondering, what makes France so unique in making it difficult to call out rape culture?
I think there is no difference. Patriarchy is everywhere. So, but, you know, in front of the city house, it's written, or free, the sentence, it's liberté, égalité, fraternité. Freedom, equality, fraternity. But fraternity can be called brotherhood too. And brotherhood, or fraternity, is a huge value in France. But what does this word mean, really? It means that men are together, and it's a male culture. And they are together, but for what? Against women. They make war against women. You know, we say liberté, égalité, fraternité, just as if it was something really nice, really beautiful, but fraternity speaks only about men. And in France, when you speak about French culture, you speak about male culture. So we have to destroy that. For me, I cannot bear to hear that sentence. Liberté, égalité, fraternité, no. Freedom, equality, solidarity, yes. But fraternity, no. Fraternity is not possible anymore. Because I am really cruelly conscious that there is a war against women. And if we, each one of these men, you know, they were In the trial, there were 51, but there are probably many more. Some of them refused to come and rape Giselle. It was a minority, but they did refuse. But none of them denounced what happened to the police. None of them. Only one of them could have stopped everything. Just one had to just call the police and say what happened. It was crimes. And so what does it say about us? It says that every man, even the men who didn't want to participate, felt that it was not such a problem because it was only women. And that the solidarity between men, brotherhood, is much more important than the simple humanity, the fact that we are a society composed by men and women, and we have the right to be respected, and that we are humans too. So I don't know what to say about French culture. I live in French in France. I have been in the US. I think it's not so different.
I know this case has shown that it's galvanized a lot of women in France.
Yes.
What do you think is going to come out of this? And what is, now that the verdicts were announced a couple of weeks ago, where do you see feminists going from here?
It's quite a hard question. I hope that there will be an after the trial. You know, there has been a before and there will be an after. And as a feminist, I will do my best for it to happen, the after. We have to change the society and men have to be part of it. Men cannot just say, oh, I feel shameful, or, oh, not all men. They have to change the relations they have with us and they have between themselves. And I think this is the real problem, the male society. So right now, I don't know what form it will take. But I know that as a feminist, I think we have been too patient and that we won't be so patient in the future. And I ask women to join feminist movements and to make justice by themselves when they are not heard. We have to ask the justice politely once, but when justice is not be done, we have to make justice by ourselves.
And what have you noticed with the teenagers that you teach? Have you noticed that the women and the boys have been galvanized by this? Do you feel like this has opened up a dialogue? What do you see as the change that this has brought about?
It's not the same for boys and girls. For the girls, many of them understood things that they were living. You know, I have been speaking a lot in the classroom during my courses about it. And I have spoken about, you know, my pupils know who I am. And they saw me in the media. Say, hey, madame, I saw you on TikTok yesterday and so on. So we speak a lot about it. And not once, but almost every day. So for mine, the girls and the boys, I am the teacher. I think they have understood many things. The girls understood what is sexual violence. And I think they understand better than before their rights and the limits, how to put limits. And the boys, it's really, I think it's quite hard for them because as a man, you have to be ashamed of what happened. You cannot, you know, it's a trap. Either you want to help, but how, and or you want to be hidden and to wait so that it's finished. And many of them are longing this story to be finished, to be replaced by another one. I think not possible. This position is not possible anymore. Men, either you are against rape culture, or you are a part of the problem.
We don't get a lot of the French news in English, so I just want to ask: would you say older women have been awakened? What do you feel like the effect has been on the general public in terms of this case?
Many, many women have been traumatized, really by this trial. Because, you know, it, one day after another, you understand other things. You know, you understand how many there were. So I don't want to explain more, but it, you know, it's really trash and wow. So many, many women have been really traumatized. You know, they were on Twitter, X, and they were all the time reading what the journalists were written in their lives, all the time, all the day, all day long, every day for during 4 months. So many, many women are really angry and furious, you know, furious. And I don't know what we are going to do with that. I hope that we will burn. we will burn patriarchy, but I don't know when. I hope we will do that.
Is this the first case that's gotten so much public attention in France around rape? And because I read that there's many cases that have against celebrities, but that nothing has happened. Is this the first time that something, A, has happened that's been so public? And is this the first case that's around sexual assault that's gotten so much attention?
So at the end of the 70s, there was a huge trial not far from here in Aix-en-Provence. It was named the Trial of the Rape, Le Procès du Viol. It was Gisèle Halimi, a French lawyer, who was the lawyer of the two victims, two lesbians, who had been raped by three men in Marseille. And she managed to make the media's focus on the real problem. It was rape is a crime, and we have to treat this problem as a real problem, not like a female problem. It's male violence, and it's a crime. So Gisèle Halimi was, you know, a very famous feminist and lawyer. She was dead a few years ago. And after, there was Me Too and the Strauss-Kahn affair. So we have heard much about sexual violence, but usually in court, there is not so many medias, in particular because the victim can ask the trial to be closed and everything to be private during the trial. And Gisèle Pelicot, Gisèle, you know, it's the same first name. I think it's a chosen one, you know. And when I heard this name, I understood that she was going to fight. She chose everything to be public. Everything means even the videos, because her husband took videos of it was more than 20,000 pictures and hundreds of videos of rapes. And everything was in his computer. Everything was clean with the names, the dates, and everything. She shows that everything would be public. And she fought for that because the second week, the president of the court decided the videos not to be shown to the public because he said it could be a problem with the public. I don't know why, but it's rape culture. When the victim when a woman says something, you have to hear, you have to listen and to obey. That's it. That's it. And, you know, so it shows the videos to be shown only in private without the medias and the public. And at that moment, it was a turn in the trial. And we, Les Amazones d'Avignon, decided to support Gisèle's decision to make the trial public. So we made collages and banners on the walls. You know, Avignon is a medieval city with large walls, and we put very, very large banners to support her decision, and we spoke to medias. When I spoke to medias, I spoke personally during this period to more than 200, probably 300 medias.
Wow.
Yes, I am exhausted.
Bad.
Yes, you can. Yeah. When you you hear about me, you found me. But we chose to support Gisèle, and to make things change. You know, the sentence is shame must change side. And we wanted the decision that Giselle had taken would be respected. So we made everything, medias, collage, and so on. And so finally, the courts decided to go back and to make the videos public. So personally, when they showed the videos in the court, I didn't watch. I know what a rape looks like, unfortunately. So I didn't need to watch it. But I think it's important, especially for the medias and even for the rapists, to be in front of the reality. We must change our look of the rape. We have to look just right in the eyes and understand what it is. Rape is not what usually you hear about, you know, violence, blood, and so on. No, often it's not that. It's just men using women as a sex toy and abusing women. And by this decision, Giselle made us a very, very huge gift because she allowed us to understand her story, women's story, you know, the story of male violence toward women. And she allowed the story to be rewritten with the shame on the good side, where the rapists are. She had not to be ashamed. She didn't do anything wrong. She was a victim. Mm-hmm. And this simple decision was really, really tough to make, but it was a very good one because, in fact, she showed that she was not ashamed, that she was standing in front of them. And it was really, really hard. Really, it was horrific. But she was here and she was alive. She didn't commit suicide. You know, at the beginning, she wanted to commit suicide. And she had enough time and enough support to understand that she could do something with that horrific affair.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. And thanks to all of the contributors today, especially to Making Contact Radio. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter and sharing behind-the-scenes photos on Instagram. Or just email us, oldschoolstyle, @feministmagazine@yahoo.com. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, too. Today's intro music was by Maya Jane Coles. Thanks for listening.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting understanding
between nations and between the individuals of all nations,
races, creeds, and colors.
To gather and disseminate information
on the causes of conflict
between any and all of such groups,
and through any and all means
compatible with the purposes of this corporation,
to promote the study of political and economic problems,
and of the causes of religious, philosophical,
and racial antagonisms.
That is our mission.
It's Raul Pacheco from Ozo Motley. You're listening to KPFK. Support and turn it up.
KPFK, your progressive media outlet, is listener-supported commercial-free radio. But did you know you don't have to wait for the station fund drives to support your favorite radio station? You can donate online at any time. Visit kpfk.org. That's kpfk.org. And we thank you for your support.
Hi, this is Kurt Elling. You're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and on the World Wide Web at kpfk.org.
Night on, lady bright, in the arms of